Yes.
May I have a question in that regard, but we'll end it. How about the balance in the following situation, which is very common in our part? Let's say a temple president says, we can't maintain our temple if we pay all taxes. Let's figure out how to avoid paying taxes. I believe that there is in Vedas instructions what is how to define when taxes are too big, so and what to do. But for a bookkeeper, how to act in such a situation?
How to act in a situation? I mean, you can look into, are there rules governing, you know, taxes, because certain things get certain kind of taxing, certain things don't. So you can look into what areas are tax exempt. And if you qualify, then make your applications and do that. If not, if by looking at it, there is no adjustment that can be made, then better one takes care of them. Because Rupa Goswami also says, one should not be negligent in ordinary dealings. So something like taxes, that's ordinary dealings, like that. So one should, you know, so that means that has to be done, and you require the temples, so then you have to figure out other ways to raise money. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, but if instruction from the temple president is not to pay taxes now, let's say to have a break, for a short time, and we are figuring out how to.
Well, then you have to check and see if you can do that without getting problem later. You know what I'm saying? Like France, they hadn't paid taxes for, I don't know, for how long, and at some point then the French government decided that all back taxes needed to be paid at once. And so then it comes down to, you can't maintain the temple if you pay the taxes, but if you don't pay the taxes and later they tell you you have to pay the taxes, then you're also going to have the same problem. So better work with the problem now and try to get beyond it. Yeah, but I'm just saying is that it'll work, but ultimately, because you do have the material energy, she may or may not, depending upon one's sincerity or, you know, whatever other considerations are there, then she may apply these things, you know. That's why Rupa Goswami says in ordinary dealings, you just do what you're supposed to do. That way, you know, being in the material world when everything's going right is already difficult enough, let alone if there's complications due to not dealing with the energy properly. You know, so it's better to try to understand that it will come out that way. You know, so you know, how short term are you looking at? You know, and how long term are you looking at? You know, so one has to be careful like that, especially if it's dealing with the government or something.
I ask it because I have heard that being a kind of a king for a small kingdom within a big kingdom, you have a right to fight against that, let's say, big king if that king is not following his duties properly. So it might be interpreted that, let's say, the government is, the taxes are too big, so...
Then you have to go to them and explain. That's what I'm saying, is that if you're really serious about it, then you find someone who is qualified in tax law and put forward these questions, and then they can find out, okay, so these kind of things, if you're classified under this or registered as NGO, so many things like that, then you can get by with either less or no taxes. So then one would have to adjust the position, because it may be they just bought the house in somebody's name, but it needs to be, you know, adjusted to represent, you know, what they're taxing. Because if it's a person, then they have to pay the tax. But if it's an organization that does welfare work, you may not have to, or, you know, things like that, you know. So is that... Okay, last point in this section. A twice-born man who, not having studied the Veda, applies himself to other and worldly study, soon falls, even while living, to the condition of a Shudra and his descendants after him. Right? So we mean here, always when we say the Veda, that means, you know, the essential books of our line. So it means for us, it means Prabhupada's books. So if someone's not studying Prabhupada's books, but they study all kinds of other books like that, then there'll be a problem. If they've studied Prabhupada's books nicely, and then they go into these others to increase the application, that's fine. But if not having studied Prabhupada's books, they go out into these others, then they'll fall from their position. Because, you know, the basic thing is, dvija means progressive. Shudra means comfortable with where they are. Right? They just worry from the day to day. Does that make sense? That's why, one has to be very careful. If one can quote all these outside books and not quote Prabhupada's books, that's not good. You know, you can't have in a meeting where someone is talking something from some, you know, karmi literature, and then you bring up something devotional, and they say, well, I don't know the philosophy so good, then they shouldn't be sitting in the position they are of authority. Does that make sense? First, second, and third birth. According to the injunction of the revealed text, the first birth of an Aryan is from his natural mother. The second happens on the tying of the girdle of the munja grass, and the third on initiation of the performance of the Shrauta sacrifice. Because you see, generally Prabhupada talks about twice born, but there is purports where he talks about twija, right? Because here the Shrauta means that you're doing these big, like in the Vedic thing, you're doing these Ashwamedha yagyas or other things like that. There's a further initiation, right? Just like for us, then you have the Vedic initiation, but then you have the Pancharatrik. So technically we're Twija, like that, because you're initiated into the Vedic and then initiated in what's beyond that. Does that make sense? Among these three, the birth which is symbolized by the investiture with the girdle of the munja grass in his birth for the sake of the Veda, they declare that birth, the Savitri verse, is his mother, and the teacher his father. Right? Prabhupada's mentioned this. The Veda is the mother, or the Gayatri is the mother, and the teacher is the father. Right? So that's how one is born into spiritual life. Right? They call the teacher the pupil's father because he gives the Veda. For nobody can perform a sacred rite before the investiture with the girdle of munja grass. He who has not been initiated should not pronounce any Vedic text excepting those required for the performance of funeral rites, since he is not on a level with the Shudra, since he is on a level with the Shudra before his birth from the Veda. In other words, someone who's not second initiated shouldn't be worshipping the deities, right? That's the basic principle. I wouldn't so strongly use "of course," because when Prabhupada was here, devotees didn't have deities in their homes. If you can come to the temple, you wouldn't have. I remember Vamanadev, he was one of the disciples. Now, he had a job, he was working outside, and, you know, he would be living, you know, where it was convenient for the work. He had deities, but he was second initiated, they'd do the full worship. So the Pancharatrik tradition is in the home you have deities, you're second initiated and do the full worship. Because the idea is the archa, the deity comes as the archa form, and the most important element of that is the bath. So the difficulty comes is that they're not second initiated, they may not even be first initiated. They have, because it would be nice, it would be inspiring. But what's inspiring is they do the puja once a week or once every 2 weeks. So what does that mean? You know what I'm saying? What would you think? Just I'll give an absurd example, but technically it's not any different. But it'll be absurd enough that the point can be appreciated. You have a boy, and he really sentimentally would really like to be with a girl, right? You know, he means it would really mean a lot to him. But he doesn't have any money or any qualifications or any facilities. So he can only kind of be with her on weekends or even sometimes every 2 weeks, you know, only on a codicil. So what he does is he keeps her in the closet, right? And then once every 2 weeks, he takes her out of the closet and then, you know, maybe feeds her, does some little stuff like that, and, you know, smiles a bit like this and shows some emotion, and then puts her back in the closet, right? Would you consider that good? No. So why would the deity, in the form as the archa, which means you have to dress them, bathe them, and all that, why would that be good? When you, if you can only do a little bit, you can't bathe and dress and all that, you can only make some offering of food, and occasionally you can do something, why one wouldn't use the deity of a picture? You know what I'm saying? Because the picture is one of eight deities, it's just as much a deity as any other. Advaitacharya, his deity was the painting of that Vishakha Devi had painted of Krishna. Right? It's Madan Mohan. That's his deity. So Advaitacharya is worshipping a picture. No problem. But we think, no, it has to be the archa. Otherwise, it's you can't express all the sentiments. Yes, but then you should be doing it on a regular basis. If you can't, then a picture. Because if you have a panchatattva picture altar in a temple, then even first initiates can worship. You're not required to be second. And the fun part about it is, you know, it's time to go visit Santa Claus. You close the temple, lock the door, and go, and it doesn't matter. But if you have the archa deity, then someone has to stay back, and the puja has to go on, and everything like that. Does that make sense? So in other words, sentimentally, it's just been an accepted thing that everybody just has deities, though they don't take care of them, and it's somehow or another all right, and if you say anything more than that, you're being fanatic, but at the same time, as the reason for it is simply sentiment and lack of knowledge.
Is there a difference if they're installed?
Is there an uninstalled family? Do you have an uninstalled wife? What does that mean? What are the facilities that you can perform with an uninstalled wife? You know what I'm saying? You know, like that. You know, of course, you have to feed her, you know, in the closet. But can you have sex with an uninstalled wife? You know, or is that only installed ones you can? You understand? There's no such thing as uninstalled deities. It's a misnomer. There are permanently installed and temporarily installed. Like, I'll give an example, because they'll say, well, Prabhupada would use the term, but I'll show you how he used it. In Mayapur, means I think they're not there now, but there was a trunk that sat in Prabhupada's bedroom. You know, one of those Indian steel trunks. In there was a set of Gornitai deities, brass, big, like this. And they would sit in that box all the time. Then if there was some big preaching program, some big festival, they'd come out of the box. And when they came out of the box and went on the altar, only second initiated devotees could do the worship. And when the festival was over, they went back in the box. That's temporarily installed deities. Does that make sense? That's the thing. See, devotees create their own religious process, which is more fanatic than the actual original, right? More dogmatic. So that's the thing. If we just follow the traditional one, there's less problem. What do you do with all these deities? You know what I'm saying? Who takes care? And so like that. And so could that have anything to do with things not going well? You don't take care of Krishna, how are you going to take care of yourself? Point is Prabhupada introduced the pictures. And then in those deities, you know, temples, he said if you have six Brahmins, then you can have Gornitai deities. And if you had, I think it was 8 or 10, you could have Jagannath. And if you had 12, then you could have Radha Krishna. Right? So Prabhupada's standards were, he wanted pukka standards in these things. Because if we're practicing Bhagavat, then do that. Just chant and that, because the pictures are great. Picture, if you have flowers, you can put, if you can't, not. Because in the picture, they're already dressed, they have flowers, they have everything. So what you have, you offer. You have food, you offer it. You don't have food, you don't offer it. You have flowers, you put. You don't have flowers, you don't put. Because everything's already there. You just add whatever it is you have to add. But if you have the deities, they don't have any clothes on, right? Because it's not that devotees will buy the deities that already have clothes on. No, they don't want those. They want the ones without the clothes on. So, because Pancharatra says that the deity, when it's made, should have clothes on. Because what happens if there's a time in the future no one worships them? They still have clothes. Right? So, you know, we'll buy some clothes, we'll change them every 2 weeks or every week, because more than that is, you know, we're being fanatic. No, you think Krishna likes wearing the same clothes every day? And that, and somehow or another, that you change your clothes every day, that's fine, and that's not fanatic. Krishna has to wear them for a week or 2 weeks because, you know, you don't have the time. So then why have deities? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? The worship in the house can be simpler. You know, how many times you cook in a day, that's all you offer. A temple, it's 6 offerings, it doesn't matter how many times the devotees eat. Right? But for in the house, you cook once a day, you offer once. You cook twice, you cook, offer twice. You cook 3, or depending on what you're there, you make the rule, whatever is cooked, you offer. Simple. Does that make sense? You know, the worship is simple. You just do it simply. Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave a very simple padati. You know, goes through very, very simple, but at the same time, very devotionally full. You do all the items. There's, you know, certain prayers that he focuses on that bring out the, you know, real depth of it. You know, very simple. Can be done in 20 minutes. You know, and it's not, it's technical enough, it's satisfying to the deity and to someone they've done puja, but not so much that anybody can't do it. You know, does that make sense? We have, you know, young girls in that doing that puja. Second initiated, but they're doing, and they're very satisfied with it. It's very easy, they can do it every day, no problem. Does that make sense? So that's the standards. Otherwise, have a picture. So it's not a matter of it's not broad enough. Yes, it is broad enough. There's 8 kinds of deities. So why do we insist that this one is the only one that's a deity? Some places they just install the deity in a pot, right? With the pot with the leaves and the coconut, then do all their worship, and then after then the deity goes. You can draw the deity in the sand, do all your worship. You can worship in a yantra. Yantra doesn't require clothes. Like that. Deity in a pot doesn't require, you know, you need a coconut, but, you know what I'm saying? You don't have to give them a bath. But the Archamurti, the one element it likes is the bath. That's what you can do for that deity that you can't do for the other one. So therefore, why wouldn't you do it? Does that make sense? Right? Right. Let's say you have 2 friends. One's a lady and one's a man. Or let's say one's a lady and one's a kid. Okay? So what can you do special for the kid you can't do for the lady? Right? Buy them some sweets or, you know, go on a roller coaster ride, right? Huh? So what if you ignored all that and did something else, right? You know, take them to the opera or something. Right? Okay, so, and then the lady, you could buy her sari or ornaments and that, but the kid wouldn't care less about that. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, according to the relationship, the nature of the person, that defines what is the natural interaction. Does that make sense? So that means the home worship, it should be real. Otherwise, then it's just whimsical. And since when is whimsical ever made a relationship anywhere ever work? You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. So the devotees have these deities, they're going to do whatever they can. I'll just leave it at that. But as a standard, it's very, very far from the standard. Like that. Right? Great for the Loy Bazaar, you know, deity makers, they make lots of money. Like that, because as soon as somebody comes a devotee and they go to Brizit Vrindavan, the first thing you do is buy deities, so, you know, they're doing fine. Like that. So, you could say it's a supporting the Brajavasis and stuff like that. Is that okay? But we're pointing out is the temple shouldn't come up with, because they can't make devotees, then they'll say, oh, well, we can't do the worship like this, so we have to lower the stand, you know. And then like this, they slowly, slowly, everything disappears. Is that okay? Yes. So what? So what? Who cares? They say it's not inspiring. But if you have deities and you don't worship them fully, then that means you're not inspired either. So the difference is if you're not inspired worshiping the picture couldn't care less. But the deity you've claimed that you by you'll be inspired and you don't worship means they're not inspired. And where is your happiness going to come from? Krishna's happiness or your, you know, inspiration? Inspiration comes from, we have to know where inspiration comes from. Do we know where it comes from? You understand? According to the acharyas. By following the rules prescribed of Shastra, then that's called Vaidhi Sadhana. Now you follow them with the proper knowledge and practice. With time, you become habituated, right? And because of that purification and because of that understanding, then you get inspired to do that because you like to do it as opposed to doing it because you're supposed to. That's inspiration. So what the devotee you're talking about there, they're not inspired, they're not talking about that, which is what the acharyas say. Because utsahan or enthusiasm was endeavor with intelligence. That's enthusiasm. So what they're talking about is whimsical emotions arising from God only knows where and God only knows why. And he's not telling us, right? So, you know, so there's that great emotion, you go out and buy and you get this and that and you feel so good and then you take it home and then this and that and then you have a fight with your husband and then, you know, for 3 days you don't want to do anything and, you know, he's this and that and then so many things like that and then things come up and then there's the kid and then there's all these things like that. And then, you know, years later maybe you notice that you haven't, you know, one day since then worshipped with that enthusiasm, you know, inspiration that you talked about. The reality is enthusiasm or inspiration is based on a factual understanding of the field, a factual ability to operate the field. That's where it comes from. And if it's just going to come by hormones, then we got problems because that's where that other stuff came from. There's some sentiment for a moment, some, what do you call those things? Endorphins, right? And then everybody feels good. That makes sense? May sound harsh, but we have to define what enthusiasm means. Because the point is if we want to follow the same logic, going back to the absurd one, every teenage boy would love to get into the pants of any girl they could. It would really inspire them. Are we going to allow it to happen? Why not? Because inspiration is so important. It would be so inspiring for those boys. Should we do it? No. So then, why, if it's with us, no, forget it. But if it's God, hey, anything goes. Right? For us, we make up the rules. You know, and for God, we make up the rules. No, God makes up the rules for himself and us. The reason that we think it's uncomfortable, because that's the way God says. It says, boy wants to look at the girl, then he has to marry her. Right? He has to commit himself. He has to, you know, there has to be some equal, how you say? He's committing his life, and then she shares her life. Right? So why would something come for, so what are you doing for God? Right? You're not bathing, you're not changing his clothes, you're not doing all those things. So what are you doing for him that, you know, he's supposed to therefore sit there and reciprocate? Right? Does that make sense? Just because we don't have the faith that the picture is as good as the archa. You know what I'm saying? If it is that you're regularly going to offer those things, then to a picture, you can't bathe the picture, you can't dress the picture, you can't put on tilak and do all those different things. Can't put, you know, in bed and all. So if you're going to do that regularly every day, as the Pancharatra describes, then yes, you should have archa because you will do it. Does that make sense? That's the point. Are you going to do all those things? I don't know of first initiates that will do. I don't know of second initiates that will do. I know of a few devotees around the world that they have deities and they're still worshiping them since they got them. Chaturatma, I think he's the president of Alachua now. He's always had deities, always been worshiping for as long as I can remember, since the 70s. Like that, you know? There's a handful. Bimala Prasad, and he's in from South Africa. He's in. I think there are devotees, but I guarantee you it's a handful. Most they take it up with enthusiasm, and within weeks, if not months, they stop. And maximum I've seen anybody goes 3 years, and then they stop. Right? We're just talking deities. We haven't even got into Shaligrams.
That's what I was going to ask.
Shaligrams, if a first initiated touches them, good luck. Do we have any respect for the scriptures? The deity is somebody, you call them. The Shaligram is directly a part of the body of Lord Vishnu. You don't worship with the full 16 items properly every day. That's seva aparad. And because I chant Hare Krishna and that, it's not going to save you. Because why? You live far away. Why? Because you're a grihastha. Grihasthas don't get off the hook. You know why all these rules are here? Because there are grihasthas. If there were no grihasthas, this book would not exist. I'm telling you. Madhvacharya's rules for sannyasis is half a page. That's it. And the Brahmacharya, we're just about finished with Brahmacharya Ashram. Just about finished. And a lot of these is because he interacts with grihasthas. So if there was no grihasthas, we would not need this book. No grihasthas, you don't need economics, right? You don't have to establish who's who in the family. There's no need for sense gratification. There's no need to endeavor for liberation, because if you're not involved in, you know, family affairs and money and sense gratification and justice and morale, then you're already basically liberated. You understand? So all this is for grihasthas. So the question is, when will the grihastha accept his responsibility? So uninitiated or first initiated worshiping Shaligrams and Govardhan Shilas is absolutely, totally bogus. I can in no way, on any front, give a nanometer of space. If someone has the deities and they don't do this or that or so many things, then I'll let it slide. But Shaligrams, and that's just pure, unalloyed nonsense. Nothing less. Because what's their right? You know what I'm saying? What would you say to 8-year-olds reading Playboy magazine? Cool? No. So what's the wrong? What's the problem? They're boys. They like looking at girls.
There is a basic argument that Vaishnava is all the time better than the Brahmana.
Vaishnava, yeah. And since when have you become one? Since when have you become? You want to know when you become a Vaishnava? When you hit prema. If you're on the platform of prema, then you can say, I'm a Vaishnav. Because they'll say all these things, and what is their purpose? To simply undercut the Vedic literature. At the same time as they're going to complain about wearing devotional clothes, we should wear karmic clothes, and all these different things like this. So the only point is that they want to undercut the Vedic culture, authority of scripture, authority of guru, authority of shastra, and establish themselves as authority, and they can whimsically do whatever they like. And Krishna in the Gita describes such a person as a person in the mode of ignorance. And Bhagavatam even describes devotees who perform service in the mode of ignorance. So we can't say, well, Vaishnavas were beyond that. Kapila Muni says devotional service in ignorance, in passion, and in goodness, and pure goodness. Ignorance means you're proud of your position. You think that your material qualification, like a PhD or born in a good family, or that your intelligence makes you special amongst Vaishnavas. And you're a separatist. Separatist means you don't care for authority. Right there. Mode of passion means you're a separatist, you also don't care for authority, and you do the devotional service for the purpose of getting material benefit. Mode of goodness is you do it because you're supposed to do it. You know, you're dharmic, you're religious, you're a good person, you do them because it's the right thing to do, but it may not be because that pleases Krishna. It's the right thing to do. Pure goodness is that you do it to please Krishna. So right there is the modes of nature. Take your pick. So when you say we're Vaishnavas, we're beyond Brahman, how do you mean beyond Brahman? Vaishnav is Brahman. It's like saying the automobile is beyond car. No, the perfect Brahman is the Vaishnava. But the point is, why are they a Brahman? Because they follow these things. You don't follow these things, how is one a Brahman? You can say, no, but they know Krishna. Do they know Krishna? If Krishna wrote the Pancharatra, you want to know where the Pancharatra came from? So, Lord Brahma had heard the Vedas from Krishna. And having known the Vedas, then the Kaitava, Madhu and Kaitava demons, they came. They were special, subtle demons, mind demons, because they came for the body of the Lord from his back. So they went into Brahma's mind and stole the Vedas. So he didn't have the Vedas. So then Brahma went to Krishna and said, you please speak the Veda again to me. And then he said, but before you speak the Veda, because that'll take some time, please give me the essence first, because just in case I die before you finish explaining the Veda, that I will know the essential points. So for 5 nights, then Krishna spoke the Pancharatra. Because the Pancharatra is the process of practical applying the Veda into worship of the Supreme Lord. So the Pancharatra comes from Krishna. It is Narad Muni's service. He preaches Pancharatra and Naishkarmya. If you look in the 3rd chapter of Bhagavatam, and it tells all the incarnations, in the purport it says these are his 2 fields. Pancharatra, that's why it's called Narada Pancharatra, because when it was lost, he again reintroduced it. So Pancharatra and Naishkarmya. So how is it Naishkarmya, or how is it Pancharatra? So therefore, how is it Narad Muni's line that we're beyond Brahman, so we don't have to follow any of the rules, so therefore we do whatever we like? But it's only the rules that say about following, worshipping the deities. Otherwise, since when does a Westerner know about a deity? Wouldn't have a clue, right? So therefore, we get the idea and the principles of worship from the Pancharatra, but we follow the Pancharatra whimsically, which drops it out of the mode of goodness and pure goodness into passion and ignorance, because it's whimsical, it's separatist. It's not for the pleasure of Krishna, it's because I feel like it. Because Vaishnava means I do everything to please Krishna exclusively. But this, I'm not following the rules because I don't want to follow the rules, not because it would please Krishna more. How will it please Krishna more by me only worshiping him once on Ekadasi? How would that please Krishna more? If he's a deity. If it was a picture, great. He sits on the wall all day and he's happy there's a picture. Now if you add some worship to that, great. But as a deity, as an archa, then it doesn't add anything. So how is that Vaishnav? You know what I'm saying? So it's very cheap. These words fall out of the mouth so easily that we're Vaishnavs, we're above the rules. Who said? Who said that? Where does it come from? Who do you know in history that's done like that? Who do you know?
It's
the majority of Vaishnavs. That's okay, but where is the evidence? Where does it say that? If you're liberated, you're beyond the rules.
My Guru Maharaj told me that it's okay that I had a golden hand.
Then it's authorized by him. If there's any problem, then you work it out with him.
And that it's also create a social position for me because I am recognized as not second initiated by the Brahmana because I am a deity.
Great. So you worship the deities for social prestige. Good to know it. Then there's deity worship. You could also keep a Ferrari. That would probably boost your social prestige also. And probably be a lot less reactive. You know what I'm saying? So all these things, it's that, you know, what to do. Just for information sake, because we were involved in writing the deity worship handbook for ISKCON, for the GBC Press, which basically probably no one in this room or anyone in ISKCON's ever read. So if you bring up deity worship, you're going to get this kind of position. So if you don't want this kind of answers, ask someone else. Yes?
There is this one story, I don't know if it's a kind of deity worship, one lady found, one lady found, brought to Prabhupada, and then he said, yes, this is Jagannath, and there are two more, so go and have them. And then all the devotees went there and bought these devotees, and I think they were hanging them on the street.
Yeah, around their neck. They made this little pouch and they all had Jagannath, yeah. So do you see that today?
No.
Yeah, so did you see it during Prabhupada? When I joined, it wasn't happening. The devotees are very enthusiastic. Here, you're dealing with a bunch of malechas and yavanas who have never done any of this kind of thing, and with great enthusiasm and innocence, they go and buy that. But how long did it last in a society like that before devotees learned, right? In other words, if you're innocent and don't know, that's one thing. But if you know and then you have excuses like, we're Vaishnavas, we don't care for the rules, even though what we're discussing is Vaishnav rules. Nectar Devotion, there's 64 items given there. It's a whole book. The whole first section is the rules of Vaishnav conduct. And then we say, we don't care. There's a Bengali saying, you sharpen the knife on the tree, you cut the tree that you sharpen the knife with. In other words, you take the knife, you sharpen it on the tree, and then to test if it's sharp, you cut the tree. So that's the thing, is devotees didn't know zip about Vedas, deities, philosophy, Vaishnavism, anything. They learned it all from Prabhupada and any rule from Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada says we don't care for rules, right? Okay? So then what rules Prabhupada gives, devotees apply his point on him. And say the rules that Prabhupada gave us, we don't have to follow because we're Vaishnavas. Yeah, that's the point. So that is insincere. Prabhupada's the one that introduced high grade worship. He introduced worship that's on the standard, if not higher than what is in our major temples. And now most of our temples, the standard in the temple, a lot of times is not as good as some Indian in their home. So they've dropped it from top temple, you know, Sri Rangam, Tirupati, you know, Jagannath, this kind of level of worship, down to not even as good as a proper Brahmin's worship in a house. Just some sentimental Hindu, some, you know, business family, they have some worship. They do better worship than most of our temples. And it's cleaner. And the food's better. Clothes are better, everything. You know what I'm saying? We play with all this stuff like it's a game. But when it comes to money, then all the, you know, the nails and teeth come out, and then we're really serious. But if it's not money, oh, it doesn't matter. We're devotees. But if it's money, we're devotees. What do we care for money? What do we care for bureaucracy? What do we care for management? We chant Hare Krishna. We don't care. No, you have to have. So what is that? What religion is that? Yeah, that's the point. It's called businessman's religion. Because whatever it takes to get money, that's all that counts. Anything else is nice. If it happens to be religious, great. If it's not, who cares? We got the money. The religious man is poor. I wasn't religious, I got the money. Who's laughing? Right? I'm laughing. You know, that idiot religious guy. That's the way they work. So is that the way we're going to work? So that's the point. So we have to know, is there standards? And if the leadership doesn't know standards, then it doesn't work. Before we had these standards, how much facility was there in the society? Now we don't care for any standards, how much facility is there? Right? Who means, when we refer to money, what's the generally the term, the devotional term we use? Lakshmi. Is she a person, or is she just pieces of paper with little faces on them? Right? She's a person. And how do you please Lakshmi? By pleasing Krishna. So that means if you're pleasing Krishna, then there's plenty of Lakshmi. And if you're not pleasing Krishna, there is no Lakshmi. Connect the dots. That's all. So in other words, the approach that's being used now is not pleasing Lakshmi, therefore there isn't any. Does that make sense? It's simple. You know, so that degree that we're pleasing to, that degree that's there. Not, we're not saying something, because there are projects. There are projects, tons of money. Another project is nothing. And if you check, much of the time is the one that has tons of money is generally following all these, you know, how you say, mundane, non-Vaishnavic, you know, not so important rules and regulations that we're discussing. Yes. So what is the grihastha in his home doing? Is it because of his deity worship? Right, we're connecting there. Is it because probably he does what his boss says? Or he follows the principles of business? That's why he does? But do we follow the principles of administration? No. So why would anything flourish? If a temple president can't act as one, then how will things flourish? If he doesn't consider the devotees in the community properly, he just thinks they're here to pay money to maintain the temple, how will it flourish? So in other words, they're doing their duty, so they're flourishing. And the temple's not doing theirs, that's why it's going down. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. It's direct. So before is that, you know, things were simple. But things weren't there. And also, it's like, before, it's like, what was the temple in the 70s? You got, the cheapest place in the cheapest part of town. And, devotees got together. There was nothing in the temple. So the only expense really was, you know, the rent and the boga. Like that. So how much does that take, right? But nowadays, you know, you have to have the cars and, you know, everybody gets paid and all these different things like that and so many things, right? I mean, I remember seeing one advertisement, one of the ISKCON, you know, somehow or another, you know, whatever they were at. They were talking about a position of temple president in one temple someplace, and they were saying that there's insurance and dental. Nice, you know, so now someone will want to come and be the temple president because they get all these things. So they get an apartment, car, and dental, and like this, you know. So, wow, great. So how much does that cost? Right? So before it was, the temple meant totally naishkarmya. So therefore, so much is there. But if we want the temple to be on the same status as the grihasthas, then there has to be some other method there. Either you have to have a real lot of people that are naishkarmya, so you have that kind of money, or you're going to have to run businesses or this or that. And so, therefore, then you should look into, you know, what does the Catholic Church do, or what do these things do? You know what I'm saying? Because they, you know, Jesus was a carpenter, right? That's how he made his money, right? And then in his spare time, he'd preach. You don't hear of him preaching all the time. How many lectures are there? You understand? Does that make sense? Because the thing is, whatever he said was great. So why isn't there thousands of lectures? No, because whenever there's a time when people could get together and all that, because they're all grihasthas, then they would have some program. No? The guy was a carpenter. Right? So, therefore, there's nothing to maintain. So the thing is, yes, you do like that, then you can do. But we expect, no, everyone's going to pay tax on that, we're going to sit here and not protect, and then how is it going to work? How are they supposed to take care of that? Because if you're no different than them, then why would they be inspired to give you money? Right? Unless you want to be a charity case, and then they can feel superior to you, but you're not going to let that happen, because you're the temple president, so you're going to put them in it, that they have to give their, you know, it's their right, to, you know, it means your right to take the tax, and if they don't, then they're nonsense. Who wants to give? What businessman would ever give part with his money that he made by hard work to someone he can see is not working? You understand? So, therefore, it's not just so simple as, well, they got deities and they got money and we got deities and we don't have money. It's that they're doing their duties, we're not doing ours. We do ours, then the point is you do yours and you have the facility to do your duty. But having money isn't necessarily the temple's duty. It only needs how much it needs to run itself. So, therefore, is it a matter of we need a certain amount, we got to get it, or we adjust our lifestyle to how much we have? Because grihastha is adjusting to how much he has. The temple is, no, we need this much and we demand. You know what I'm saying? So it's very different than it was before. But we can see by before, then there's so much. That's the point, is if you're renounced, you have so much. And if you want it, it goes away. We haven't seen this principle. You have the female pigeon, the male pigeon. She's just there, you know, eating, minding her own business. The male pigeon comes up. She just ignores him. And as he moves, she goes away. Right? And he keeps chasing her all over the place. And then when he gives up and just sits there himself, then she flies over. That's the point. We think, I'm going to control it and get it. No, you're not. You don't try to control it, you'll get it. You try to control it, you won't have it. That's why we're saying control is only as useful as it organizes the devotee's involvement in the devotional process, not in the economic process. Economic is important, but it's only one part of human life and a small part of the devotional movement. Because one can go out preaching all day as long as one has some kartals and a mridanga. And even if he didn't have that, you get something, get some bongos and, you know, an old tin can and start, you know, it'll work. You know what I'm saying? That's all that one requires for preaching. And then you'd have to have enough food to be able to eat to do that and a place to lay down to sleep so that you're, you know, don't, you know, you're not sick, so the next day you can do that. That's basically all that's required. Deities are on top of that, you know, so many offices and authorities and computers and this and that. And so you could probably run a temple really nicely that never had a computer and didn't even have email. It may be shocking. It may be shocking, but you probably actually could, and you might actually find that you do very well in the area where you are. Now, when you go into a yoga studio, you know, you're impressed because when you come in, there's, you know, a big, you know, computer and people doing all that. That's why you come to the yoga studio, right? No, you come to the yoga studio because when you come to the yoga, it looks like a yoga studio. You know, you come in, it's peaceful and got all this far-out stuff and quiet and nicely done and aesthetic. So does our temples look like that? You walk in and you look like you walked into an embassy of Gaudiya Vaishnav culture? No. So therefore, why does anyone go? The yoga studio looked much more nice. But we have this idea, unless you have all this stuff and that, you can't do devotional service. No, you can do it very nicely without any of it. Does that make sense? So the whole point is we have to actually look at what we're doing. And then, you know, the point is if we want to function at that, great. But then make a plan that actually deals with the environment we're in. You know, what is the temple? What are the devotees? What can they do? What's the community? What they can do? And make a suitable plan for that. not just I'm the temple president, what I say everybody's got to do, and because the temple, you know, demands that you give this much percentage. Because what do they always say? Now, churches that have been running for a long time, how much do they ask from their members?
10%.
How much do we always demand? 50. And that's only because we take 100, but, you know, Shastra only says 50. But where does it say 50%? Does Rupa Goswami says 50% has to go to the temple? No, he says 50% should be given in charity to, you know, deities, Vaishnavas, you know, preaching, this and that. Point is, the Grihastha made the money. It's their sadhana and right to give it to whoever they please. The temple does something that impresses them, they give money to the temple. The temple doesn't, they don't. And then a traveling preacher does, they give it to him. And the temple says, no, it's our right to have that money. On whose order? Right? On whose order? A grihastha is independent. That's why he's a community member. So we have to be very careful that in expanding the authority of the temple, we're not making the temple just, we've included now the community as the temple, so therefore now we have the same control over them as the brahmacharis. That means one doesn't understand what a grihastha is. One doesn't understand what the maximum a king can take in times of emergency is 25%, maximum. The normal thing is 18 or 16.5%. That's the normal. But if there's emergency, he can go up to 25. He can't go beyond that. It's illegal. So when we say you have to give 50%, that's why nobody does any businesses for the temple. There's plenty of Aishas they could do, but they won't. Why? Because the temple demands 50%. Where's the investment? How can you do things that... So we sold this, we made this much profit. So then the temple says, that's profit. So now 50% of that we get. Or if not 100%, it's the temple business. Where's the investment to increase it? You know, where is the payment to the person who did all the work? You know, where's the ways that he says we can expand? None of that's there. You know, saying so it's not efficient. That's why no one who knows how to make money generally will work with any of our temples. Does that make sense? And all it is we simply have to educate ourselves so that we know how to deal with it. Does that make sense? Because the point is the temple president is the authority. But he has to know what works in the principle of authority. How much to take, how much to demand, who to demand what from. If he knows that, then he'll be successful. Because there are people you can get more from, people you get less from. But if he wants the same from everybody, it means he's not discriminating, so he'll get nothing from anybody. You know what I'm saying? You know, that's the...
The understanding is this 50% doesn't mean only the money, you know. It means that, I don't know, Prabhupada in one lecture explained that for Shudras it means some work, something to help with the affairs.
Yeah,
but so pay the money.
Shudras do what they can.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the thing is that but you have to take care of Shudras. Shudras means if the Shudra works for you, you feed him. So we want him to work for the temple half time and they have to take care of themselves. No, that means you feed him, you clothe him, you give your old stuff to him. The rule is that if you have Shudras, you can't sell your old furniture. You have to give it to your Shudras. You can't sell your old clothes. You have to give it to your Shudras. So that means that old Gucci bag that your wife has that she's not using, that goes to your Shudras. So does the temple follow that rule? You want to take these things. That's why Prabhupada said we have to study this. We're trying to take it from an idea where we don't even have a clue what it means. Because Shudra means you take care of them fully. So the rule is because he's doing his work for whoever he is, the king, I'm not sure, will come across it. I think it's one day in a month they have to work for the king. They do a full day's work for the king. One day. Not 15. One. So that's how much they can give. Because how much does a Shudra make? Right? Because you're taking 50% from profit. Now, if you have to pay your, you know, your mortgage and your rent and your food bills, that's not profit. So it means what's left over. There is something left. Now, you got your check, you know, you got your 1,000 euros and that, and then after paying all your bills, you know, that was, you know, 700, you know, and things like that, then that means you have 300 left. So now we're talking about 1,500 of that. But that's not how devotees will look at it. They'll look at it, you got 1,000, so 500 of that's ours. That's bogus. Because it says in here that the king has to know what it means. If you want to take a tax, you have to know what it took to buy it, transport it, you know, store it, all the different taxes he had to go through from different kingdoms to get to this place. So what was his actual full investiture? Then how much can you actually sell it for in the market here? Right? Because the king controls the prices. And so then he sees there what's there, and then he out of that takes a fair tax. And some things the markup's not great, some things it is. Something like gold, even though it's very expensive, the markup's very small. Right? You know, they make it have a making charge of, you know, a few rupees and this and that. So you can only take 2% off of gold. But some other things you can take 20%, depending upon what it is. So all these things are considered. So if we consider all that, then each case is individual, but we just say 50%. But the point is 50% what you're working towards, you know? So the point is does the president and what he gets and what's left over, does he give away 50%? He'll consider, no, I'm the president, I don't have to. No, but you're a Brahmin, you have to. Right? I went to one temple a program at the temple president's house at one place. Afterwards, he gave me a check to ISKCON for $18. Indudunamars gives them back and says, oh, I'm sorry, you're so you know, destitute, you need this more than I do. He'll give it back. So in other words, there's this idea of entitlement that's there, that because I'm the authority, then I don't have to follow the rules, but everybody else does. No, the rules, as ashram, everybody follows the rules. Then in Varna, it has to be organized. So therefore, there's an authority. So we have to be able to see is that even though we're the temple president and we are the authority, we're still an individual within the Vaishnav mission. And we have to follow what applies to the individual. Then we're trying to organize everybody else's life so that they can be engaged nicely in congregational chanting. So what that takes, that's what we're doing. But just this idea that I'm in charge and that makes me, you know, gives me the right for anyone, the divine right of kings. Generally speaking, it didn't work too good for most of the Western kings. They most all, you know, got killed, left off, poisoned, something. You know, one or two of them made it, but Queen Elizabeth made it. But her sister didn't, and her cousin didn't. Yes, yeah, so that's what the temple president's profit should be also. No insurance, no dental, no fancy rental in some place, no paying your kids, you know, bills to send your kids to the Steiner school. None of that. Your profit is the devotional service. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. It goes both ways. But that's the problem. That's why people don't want to give to the temple, because they see temple president has the big fancy car, he lives in the big fancy thing, you know, he does this and that, his kids go to the fancy school, they fly to India twice a year like this, his wife, you know, walks around with her Louis Vuitton bag, this and that and all this stuff like that, and, you know, and the same point is 50% is demanded, but they don't see him doing anything for this. You know, he shows up at 9 o'clock, office time, goes home at 5, he's not there at the morning program, brahmacharis get hell for not following, everybody else is in maya because they're not giving to the temple or living in the temple. Who wants to give to that person? I wouldn't. Right? So you either live outside, or if you're really worried about association, I'd pack up and move to a place where there was a temple that I really liked the administration. But, you know, most devotees don't think like that. You know, they're from one place and they don't think about moving, so they just stay in their place. And you know what I'm saying? So they're not inspired to give the temple, and then when the Swami comes through and somebody gives to him, because they're inspired, because they think he's doing a great job, then the temple says, no, this is bogus. All money belongs to us. So if all money belongs to you, hey, this city is really big. They probably turn over billions here. So how much of this is your right? Go out there and tell the government, hey, we're the temple. You owe us money. It doesn't work like that. You have to behave in a way that they want. Otherwise, then it's the same thing. That's the way the men deal with the women. That's the way the parents deal with the kids. Just because I'm the authority, you do what I say. But that's where's the cooperation? So that's why it fails. Because before, is as I was saying, the temple president lived exactly the same way we did. He just, you know, slept in this office. Like that. And his wife was there. You know, you could tell he was the temple president, you know, not because of the cow dung, but because he had a desk. Right, we had BTG boxes, right? So that's how you can tell we were the brahmacharis, right? All our stuff in the BTG box. He had a BTG box, but he also had a desk, right? So that meant he was the temple president, right? But he lived the same lifestyle, ate the same food, wore the same clothes, followed the same program, did everything we did. So there's no difference. Just he's in charge of it to make sure that we did it. But nowadays, I have been to some temples year after year and never see the temple president. Never. Right? They're giving lectures. I won't see the temple president. Like that. One time I saw once, they came, and then because of the temple president, they asked some snooty question. I didn't know he was the temple president, right? Because I'd never seen him, so I gave him a really strong answer like this, and then he never came again. Right? And so that person's going to be inspiring. So this is the point, is that it's, if we're talking about inspiration right here, the question is inspired. And then your point was, is that we're devotees, we're beyond the rules. So if we're inspired and beyond the rules, then why do we need all this that they have to follow what we say? We're beyond the rules. So that's what I'm saying, is when it comes to administration and money, no, it's completely smarta. But when it comes to anything outside of that, then we're completely sahajya. So that's the point of these, the razor's edge, because that's the two sides. One side smarta, one side sahajya. Does that make sense? So that's our tendency. So when Prabhupada says these things, you have to see what's the context, like that. And you also have to see if it's a letter. And the weakness of the letter is you don't know what the original was. And when it comes between the books and a letter, Prabhupada said the books are the authority. Like that. Because the letter was to a particular person for a particular situation, which may have, you know, broader range of application, but most of the time it's an indication on what to do. Not that this is exactly, Prabhupada said this in the letter, so this is what we do. No, that was what he did for that person in that situation. So we have to be able to see. And you also have to understand how it worked out and what's the culture behind it. You know, Mataji says, you know, everybody went out and bought Jagannath deities. But, you know, so one is that the Jagannath deities don't end up in somebody's house sitting there on the shelf, you know, so the devotees have them. But, you know, it went for a while. Right? I think one devotee actually even got out of the army that way. Because he went there and he had, and they asked, what's that? So that's God. You know, so I wrote down crazy, you know, he was out, you know, like that. So, you know, it had its advantages, right? So you have to understand when there's innocence. Like a small kid, it's like this I say the little child does something because he's innocent. Everybody laughs or, you know, agrees or this or that. But 10 years later, can he do the same thing? No, so that's the difference. You know what I'm saying?
And that's why it was so sweet.
Yeah, that's the point. is that sweetness. But that principle of that sweetness may not come innocence, but the that purity can be there, and it can generate the similar thing. Because sweetness can be gained by many methods. You know what I'm saying? You can put sugar, you can have sweetened fruit, you can use honey, you know, like that. So the detail, there's many ways to get one, quality, right? Because the quality is Krishna. And the various forms and methods, that's all Lakshmi, right? Yeah, so if that dedication is there and something, this one seems to be dead. Yes.
Gurudev told me once about a temple where the temple president demanded 50% of all money that was donated to my Gurudev just 50%. Although that temple didn't cover any expenses related to that visit. What kind of management is that?
It's called people who have no respect for authority and are money-minded. That's all. So, but unfortunately, it is a GBC resolution. And I was in the meeting when they made it, and I was trying to explain the position of all this and that. But their point is that because, you know, we make the devotee, we do all this, so we deserve the money. So some were coming in from the Kshatriya angle, but most were coming in from the Vaishya angle. And all, basically, except for the Kshatriya angle, all of them were coming in from the disrespect of authority angle. And so then that rule is there. Because you do have some preachers that will go into an area and collect money. Because let's say they were there before, know the people there, and so they'll collect money from the area, and it'll affect the temple. See, it's one thing as if there's a difference between when I'm speaking here, I'm speaking about the person's not giving any money to the temple, so if they give it to somebody in ISKCON, that's better than giving it to nobody, right? So if they're not inspired by the temple, but they're inspired by some other project or a preacher, and they give there, at least it's within the society. I'm not talking about where that, let's say the person was somehow involved with that yatra before, knows all the big donors and all that, and used to collect for the temple. Now they're not. They're out traveling and they don't have anything to do with that yatra. Now they come to those big donors, get donations from them, and now those donors don't give to the temple. That's bogus. That's nonsense. That should not happen. Because those are the temple donors. And if they're going to give, you know, let's say they give 1,000, you know, euros to the temple, then that should go there. It shouldn't be, oh, I'm sorry, I already gave it to this Swami. No, that shouldn't happen. But if it's someone who's not giving and they give to that person, great, they're giving to the society. No one should demand anything of that because the point is you can't take money from a Brahmin. No one is authorized to take money from a Brahmin. And if they're doing it as managers, that's even worse. If they were doing it as we're Brahmins and we see the superior thing and so therefore we're taking it from that. But you can't tax Brahmins. You just can't. Money given to a Brahmin is his.
But what if the management is not managing the temple properly? Then like they're using money for...
That's what I'm saying. So people don't give.
Yeah, but what if you used to give but then you found out, okay, they're not...
Then you stop giving.
Yeah, but then you can still give to other Swamis.
Yeah, but just... Don't let anybody know. Because the point is it should be that the local devotees are inspired to give to the local temple. Right? That's the way it should be. But that means that the local temple is inspiring them. Like you look at Chopati. There's 100 brahmacharis there. That's all that's there. But there's 6,000 or 7,000 in the congregation. Right? Where did those 6,000, 7,000 came from? Because the 100 brahmacharis preached. Right, and they don't ask anybody for anything, but the community takes care of everything there. Right? In fact, the community manages the accounts and all the payment of money. The brahmacharis just preach and take care of the deities. That's all they do, and take care of the brahmachari ashram. That's their only responsibility. So the temple president of the Chaupati temple means he manages the brahmacharis, the deities, and the preaching. He doesn't have anything to do with the accounts or anything else like that. You know what I'm saying? So it can be done. So what they're doing, that has to be understood. What are they doing that impresses the community? Because I've heard them say, you know, the senior community members, that they respect the brahmacharis almost like the sannyasis, you know, basically on the same level. But the sannyasis, of course, are more. But the same, because they just see that their commitment and dedication, and that's why they want to support and give, right? That's all, you know. But if they see is that it's just turning into this, you know, whole kind of thing, then that's where you get so many branches, right? You know, where did Francis of Assisi come from? Why he wasn't just doing what everybody else did? You know what I'm saying? Why do these all, they break off? Because of these same problems. Why was the reform movement there? Because of these same problems. So these are always what comes, because you have a ritual, so the natural thing is to ritualize the ritual, and which is okay as long as it's inspiring. But as soon as it's not inspiring, then you have a burden. So the idea is that the deity worship should not be a burden. Right? So that means everybody's inspired. The temple should be a burden. Everyone's inspired. So that's the point, is as leaders, we have to find that. That's why we're discussing these things, because these are the basis by what inspires somebody. If you have knowledge, you inspire. You have the equanimity of mind, you inspire. You know, you speak nicely, you inspire. You know, you respect authority, you inspire. Right, you know, you have the proper purity and all that, you inspire. You know, does that make sense? So that's the idea, is that what are the techniques that as a leader you can inspire those that you are leading? That's the idea, because why we're doing it, because the modern has all kinds of, you know, techniques, but they don't work. So what we're trying to show is that the Vedas, they work, and that how to understand the principle and relate it in the context of, you know, the situation we're in, right? Does that make sense? Because when we say modern, all this changes people's mentality, not their needs. A husband's needs haven't changed. A wife's needs haven't changed. A child's needs haven't changed. Parents' needs haven't changed. A teacher's needs hasn't changed. Student needs hasn't changed. Businessman's, government's, nobody's needs have changed in principle. Right? In detail, that's there according to the time, but that'll always be changing. What's changed is the mentality on whether they're willing to see this in relation to God's laws or not. That's the only thing that's changed. Does that make sense? You know, previously, that was the main thing, the God's laws, up until about, I think, I'm not sure when it was, about 3,000 years ago. No. I'm talking about going back to the Ionians. They're a group of early Greeks, one group. They were rationalists. So with the introduction of their philosophy, it may have even been 3000 BC, so they would have been around the start of the Kali Yuga. So it started to break down the authority of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. And success was quantified by Vaishyas and Shudras in money and numbers. Right? And so that just increased with time. And then we see is that then with Christianity, then breaking down the unity between philosophy and religion, then that was totally destroyed by them. And then, so now you have a culture that's based on numbers, right? Based on numbers. That doesn't have a connection between your philosophy, your religion, your culture. And then that won't function. So all you have is sentiment, right? And so in both of these cases that we're talking here, we're talking sentiment only. Oh, we chant Hare Krishna, we're above the rules of Vaishnavas. Oh, but what about inspiring and all? right? Where was it, in Berlin? Was it a few years ago? They installed, you know, like monster Jagannath. The yatra was falling apart, almost finished. And so they thought by installing these Jagannath deities, they'll boost the yatra, everything will come together. Did it? No, I think they're in somebody's house. You know what I'm saying? So the idea is that sentiment won't do it. It has to be sentiment with a good plan. Right? Sentiment's important because we're humans, but if there's not a good plan, it won't work. So the only plans that work are those in line with God's laws. Right? Hidu Pradesh, which is like the, you know, the essential Niti Shastra, it says whoever has the better plan wins. It's not who's stronger, who has the bigger army, it's who has the better plan. That's all. You know what I'm saying? Yes.
This is so, like this example of people being inspired and them giving. It's when we see these people as kind of pious people who are looking to serve and, you know, want to be engaged in devotional service, and then they see something which is not quite okay. But they might be also kind of like, let's say, crooked.
Yes, but they're crooked and they're not expecting any charity.
Yeah.
Well, you are. So why do you give to Brahmins? Because they're supposed to be in a pure state. Why don't you give to Kshatriyas, Vaishyas? Because they're not. You understand? So there's a difference. You can't equate it like that because you're the one receiving the charity, not them. The point is if you preach and educate, then you can also, one, get by those things, but at the same time as you have to be working on it. There's a difference between there's something wrong and you're working on it, and that there's something wrong and you feel, what's the big deal? You know what I'm saying? So let us say, you know, there's a grihastha and he has a problem with the four regulated principles. As long as he's trying to correct that, it's progressive. But if he thinks, what's the big deal, you know, it's Kali Yuga and we're grihasthas and, you know, why all this, you know, that's fanatic, that's nonsense. So in the same way, the temple may have things because we're in the positions we are because we're devotees. Now, if we have the material qualification, better. But even if not, better a devotional person who's not so materially qualified than a greatly materially qualified person who's not devotional. Because we've even seen that. We've had temples like that, but they don't work very good. The devotees still aren't satisfied. I think London has been an example of that. They've had some really great managers, but not so devotional. The devotees weren't very happy. So the devotional is your main element. So in that, there's going to be a problem either in managerial, you know, you're not able to take care of this and that, and so many things don't work nicely. Or, you know, there is the personal thing. The president is a person, and he's trying his best. The point is ideally he should be the one who can manage. So that's why he's in that position. Not that he's better than the other devotees, but he's the manager. Just like, who do you pick for the cook? The person who's better than everybody else, or the person who knows how to cook? Right? But he should be sincere in trying to improve his own personal life because his cooking will affect the consciousness of the temple. Right? That's another way of looking at it. Look at your cook. Who's cooking? Right? And so you want to have that balance. So as long as you're trying that your own personal life, then you can explain that. I'm trying, this, you know, these are our weaknesses, this is what we're trying to do, and you're trying to do yours. And so the point is that the money is not for the president, the money is for the temple and the temple projects. So therefore, Krishna consciousness is a worthwhile investment, no matter how well or not it's managed. You know what I'm saying? If the temple being managed very badly, right, still it's worth giving there because it's for Krishna. You know what I'm saying? But the point is what we're discussing here is not the validity of giving to the temple. What we're discussing is, as a leader, what you can do to make it that people want to give to the temple. Does that make sense? Because in all this, why would I be going through Manu if we didn't respect authority? Right? Right? Otherwise, you know, we start with others, you know, Proctor or Carnegie or, you know, all these kind of guys. Like that. At least, what's his name? The guy with the bald head? Covey. At least he's you know, Christian. You know, he believes he's religious. You know? So the point is we're trying to establish that what you can do to make it work, not say that, no, but we're the authority and the point, because it's not working. The devotees have tried to work on we're the authority since, you know, 87, and it really hasn't worked. You know what I'm saying? Especially as the longer we get away from that time when you had, you know, people inspired by the big gurus. It's just, you know, if they don't know how to run it, it's not inspiring. So what we're trying to do is think how to materially make it work, because the gross comes from the subtle. Right? That was one of the first points. In creation, gross comes from subtle. What your mind is what your senses are, therefore the situation. Right? You know, he thinks like a fish, therefore he has the senses of a fish, therefore he's in the ocean. Right? Like that, until he becomes some sushi somewhere, then, you know, like that, but still. Does that make sense? So, is that okay? So, what we have to get beyond is trying to justify our position that's not working. And figure out is the position doesn't need to be justified. It is there, but we have to know how to balance it with all the other things that are also fully authorized. So how to that our, you know, the president, you know, as the authority, the deity worship, the Samkirtan, you know, the community, the individuals within the temple and the community, like that, you know, the temple within the country within, you know, like Europe here. How does that all work? That's why then your qualified, mature persons are in the positions of leaders, because they have to deal with all that. Otherwise, just make, you know, anybody the president. You know? But it's the person who can accommodate this. So the thing is we have to be able to work on that and broaden our understanding, because we already have the tools, we already have the experience, we just don't necessarily have the awareness of what we have. You know what I'm saying? Because as we go through here, you see Prabhupada, we're constantly coming across points that Prabhupada makes. But the little details that are in there, Bhagavatam doesn't have to mention that, because Bhagavatam is technically for someone who's already studied all this. Right? You studied the Veda, right? Then you studied all the supplementary literatures. Then from studying all that, you understood something's missing. So what's missing? The direct explanation of the personality of Godhead. Therefore, Bhagavatam. Right? So therefore, Bhagavatam doesn't explain these things in detail, because all those sages who were there when Sukadeva Goswami spoke, they all knew all this. Right? So what happened when Sukadeva Goswami walked in? They were already sitting and talking. What happened? They all stood up. Where did that come from? Here, from Manu. Right? So they all knew these things. So that's why it's there. So when we say, we don't care, no, we don't care for that Manu stands on its own without God consciousness. That's what we don't care for. But this is just the social rules of how human beings behave. We don't want to follow it, fine. Because we can say, well, in the society, modern society, they're not doing, but we have to understand the modern society is not human. It's tribal. That's all. Tribal doesn't mean you're not sophisticated. You know? Tribal means tribal. I mean, look at some of the edifices made by some of these ancient cultures. They can't make them now. They don't have the engineering to make something like the, you know, the pyramids or the, what is it? I can't remember. It's one of those cities in South America. In Peru, monster rocks that are put together so perfectly you can't even fit a razor blade. And they're not straight. It's not like they're perfectly straight so you can mill them and get it like that. But it's they're curved. But they're perfectly straight. And they're still there. While there isn't a Western thing, that has lasted that long. Right? Even the Roman stuff, which is well built, well, some roads are there, but the surfacing is needs. But other than the roads, most of the stuff's not there. And they were good builders, right? You know, but you know, stuff from the Middle Ages. You know, if you know, what do you call it? Not palaces; those are castles, right? Yeah. You know, a few things here and there, but most things are not. Like Prague's still there, right? Didn't get bombed, right? You know. Does that make sense? So it's you have these things, and but they're tribals, but so sophisticated, right? They can't even figure out what Stonehenge is, right? And it's just a bunch of stones. They can't even figure out how they got them put together, right? You know, so that means that was quite sophisticated, that they could take a bunch of big stones and with ropes and whatever else and put them together. You know, modern man, he'd bring in a big crane, he could build it. But,
ET,
yeah, so, I mean, that's the best thing. And that's supposed to be modern man who is rational, right? You know? So it's just, they knew the art. Now they've lost the art. You know, it's like these guys that, they have these bales of cotton. They weigh hundreds and hundreds of kilos. You can't even move them. But they have these things with hooks. And with two hooks, they get them up onto the corner. And they can spin them and walk them for, you know, hundreds of meters. And they also have ways to stack them up. They have guys up there and they just keep spinning it and it just keeps going until they stick two, three stories up. It's an art. You don't know that art. No way you're going to do it. So we're thinking, you know, how do they carry this? You know, it'll take, you know, 50 guys to carry this. You know, but one guy moved it. So the same time as they knew the art, so that means it's sophisticated. So that's the point, is tribal doesn't mean unsophisticated. You know, it doesn't mean you have a bone in your nose and walk around topless. It means, you know, it means that wow. So how do you equate that? If you don't have a bone, but you have a piercing and you're basically topless. So does that kind of like put it in the same category? Are we talking the same kind of tribal here? Does that make sense? Like that? So that's what we have to do. So this is human life. This is how humans. So the thing is as a devotee becomes purified, they start to become more human. So they start to look for these things. If they're there, it works. But if they're not there, because the point is this particular method that is going on now has been in vogue since about 96. You know, this whole political correct bureaucratic approach. And so that means 15 years, and nothing's gotten any better where they've really applied it. And places where they haven't bothered with it, and just either, you know, direct gung-ho devotional service, then they're building stuff, they're doing stuff. What was that place in Utah? Out in the middle of nowhere, and they built like the Kusum Sarovar, like that. And they get, I think, what is that, 50,000 people or something come for their holy festival.
Mormons.
Yeah, and that's in the middle of Mormon country, you know? So it's, you know, and they're, you know, so that's, you know, it's wild. How are they doing that? Because they're just, you know, doing 1970s stuff. And it works, right? Right? When the West is falling apart and you can't do all this stuff and you can't go out on Hari Nam and you can't have gurus and you can't wear dhotis and you can't do all this and that. Russia started up right after the glasnost, right? Within a short time, 100 temples and thousands of devotees, and somehow or another, just doing the old stuff worked. Right? Until then, you know, you get the ones that weren't there from the beginning, you get all the Western people come in and bring in the Western ideas, and then it starts to fall apart. Does that make sense? You had something?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, as you mentioned about the temple presidents and basically their economics, so what is the proper way? Because, like, I remember in Uzbekistan there was about management and this would be there, and we just follow that the temple president should not have more facility than any other vinyasa in the community.
Right.
So as you explained, that should live simple and everything. On the other hand, when devotees, especially temple presidents and vinyasas, they expect that
we will be charitable and we will, I mean, give donations or if somebody in the community gets married, because we represent the temple.
Yeah, but you represent the temple, but you aren't the temple. But are you living as Brahmins or are you living as Kshatriyas? If it's because you're the temple, therefore, because you're the managers, then you're living as Kshatriyas. You can't accept charity, personally. You can on behalf of the temple. But if you're Brahmins, then there's no difference between you and another one.
But then how do we know, like, in which category?
You have to choose one or the other. You can't get both.
But what is the difference there?
The mentality. Are you, because you're the temple president, therefore you should get money? Or because you're a Brahmin, you should get money? But what did you do? There's so many Brahmins in the community. Why did some Brahmins get money at a marriage and some didn't? Those who were involved, or those who are personally known. You know what I'm saying? The person who does, so if the temple president does the wedding, then why shouldn't he get? But if he's just going to sit back and because he's the temple president and someone else does it, and so therefore he should get money, what's that?
I mean, like if somebody gets married and then of course then we are giving gifts to the couple.
Right.
And then basically, especially if this couple, they come from the temple, they are temple devotees, so naturally they expect that the biggest gift would be from the temple president.
Yeah, so then that's what you should be doing. But the point is if you're saying you represent the temple, then the point is then the temple would give something because they're temple devotees. To the community, you don't have to give zip, right? You know, but to the temple devotees, then you would give. So something from the temple. If you have something, you throw that in, whatever you have, small or big. If you're living like them, then, you know, you can't do much. But the temple could give something. So in other words, as devotees, you're giving what you can. And as the temple authority, then the temple is giving them something. You know, it's two different things. That's what we were saying with him, is that there's two aspects. There's the position as the temple authority, and then there's you as an individual devotee who is, you know, trying to engage your life in Krishna's service. So always these two have to be considered. So generally what happens is we merge the two. And unfortunately, instead of it being we're a devotee, we are the temple manager. Right? So that won't work. That's not an identity. It's no different than I'm this body. Because the reason you can manage is because of your conditioned nature. So we're still identifying with the body. Does that make sense? If he is,
yeah,
or he should be. No, should he be doing economically well, or you're saying, or you're qualifying, if he's doing economically well, he should be a good devotee? And
the people, they have this view, like, you know, like if we were trying to preach to some businessman, and then they would see that, like, we are not dressed properly.
Yes, so then you do those things, but that's what it's for. In other words, like you have that letter by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. They have the temple car, right? I'm not sure if you realize what car they were. What was the temple car? The temple car was a Jaguar convertible. You know, when that famous story, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur drove down to Radhakund, he drove in a Jaguar. Right? Nowadays, it doesn't mean much, but, you know, before the 70s, a Jaguar was something, you know, it was right up there. So he had a Jaguar, and it was convertible, so he could sit in the back. And then the devotee who was driving in the front was wearing a three-piece suit with spats, you know, like that. So, but it was the temple car. And the sannyasis, because it's a mutt, so in the temple there are no grihasthas, right? It means, that's the difference. We have temples. Temples means there can be brahmacharis, grihasthas, anybody. But a mutt means there can only be sannyasis and brahmacharis. You know, there's ladies don't live in the temple. But a temple, ladies can live in the temple. I mean, does that make sense? So So they had a mutt, so your heads are sannyasis. And so it's the mutt car. But he said no. He says, you have to go to the doctor. You walk. If you're going for preaching, you can drive the car all over, you know, the world. But if it's for yourself personally, it's not for personal use. You know what I'm saying? So if you're preaching to these people, they expect you to have nice clothes, nice this and that, then you have it for that occasion. Then the rest of the time you put on whatever you can deal with. That's all. So the point is it's not that we take on that identity or that. Because also, it's more how you wear it, not what you're wearing. Right? You know, if it doesn't have holes in it, it's not dirty, and you wear it well. Because the thing is, You must have your own experience. You can have someone who goes out to the boutique and buys, it's all brand name stuff. You know, the skirt costs 1,000 euros and the bag costs this and that. So they're wearing 10,000 euros worth of stuff, but they can wear it not well and don't look good. While someone else goes down to where the sale is going on, and they go through very carefully and choose really good looking stuff and wear it well, they look better, even though what they're wearing only costs 150, you know, euros. You understand? So that's also the point. As much of the time when we say, oh, it doesn't look nice, dhotis and that, that means we don't know how to wear it. Because Krishna wears that and he looks great. So he knows how to wear it. You know what I'm saying? So the point is if dhotis didn't look the best, if they weren't the coolest, the most kind of youthful and sporty, but at the same time as, you know, attractive, do you think Krishna wouldn't wear it? Right? If jeans were the thing that just really knocked the girls right out, completely for a loop, wouldn't Krishna be wearing them? No. You know what I'm saying? That's the point. So yeah.
Sometimes it happens that just some devotees, they know how to make things nicely, though they don't spend much for it. And then other people, they just explain it, you know, it's a luxury, and they are.
So you have to. The point is, you have to explain. In other words, the more you associate with your community, then the more they get to know who you are as a person, right? Because the temple president is just that you're the authority. That's no one's, I mean, you'll always have someone who'll question it. But in general, devotees won't question the authority of the temple president, right? But if they know you as a person, it works better. You know what I'm saying? Because, as you said, the business person is going to look how efficient you are. The administrator is going to look at that. The Brahmin is going to look at your knowledge. But your common person is just going to look, are you nice? Right? Because Shudra means surrender, so they want to surrender to someone who's nice. Because as it is, they don't like their boss, they don't like their neighbors, they hate their relatives. So, you know, it's like, you know, if you're nice, then they're willing to surrender. Does that make sense? So all these things are really simple, straightforward, human things. That's all the Shastras are trying to tell. They're just saying, be a nice person. But the only person that's actually nice is the devotee. Because everybody else has some motive that underlying, if you dig deep enough, there's something not nice. But for the devotee, what you're finding that's not nice isn't actually the deepest thing. You know what I'm saying? When you go into the karmis, it is the deepest thing. They're really nice and all that, but underneath, you know, it gets all nasty. But for the devotee, the outside may be nice, down a bit, maybe not nice, but if you go farther, it's nice again because they're all surrendered to Krishna. So on the platform of transcendence, they're all basically good. You know, I mean, it's rare. You meet every 10, 20 years, you meet someone who's like really bent on something else other than pleasing Krishna, you know. But otherwise, you just don't run into them. So the devotee is just what's kind of in the middle. That's the leftover residues of their conditioning. But them as a devotee, as a soul, they're fine. And much of the time as their direct interface, then they're generally okay. But, you know, some of them need to work on that too. You know what I'm saying? But when you go in, that's where you're going to find stuff. Because if you find stuff there, I wouldn't worry about it. If they're not committed to Krishna, then I'd worry about it. You know, but that's no excuse either. That's the whole point, is the Vedas, hard as a thunderbolt, soft as a rose. So when we're sincere, then that's soft as a rose. When we have attitude, then it's hard as a thunderbolt. So both are there, it's balanced. You know? Does that make sense? So we have to find that, because we tend to, it's either hard as a thunderbolt or soft as a rose, and that's it. You know, we're a manager, and so what we say, that's it, and that's finished. But there's no soft side. And then there's others that, oh, we have to work together, and, you know, we're all the same. We don't even call it the community, because it has to be just the greater temple, the greater, you know, like this and that. But where's the standards? They don't have any. So one has standards, but they're not nice. And the other is so nice, but no standards. But the idea is to have standards and be nice. Or, yeah. Does that make sense? So that's what we're discussing, is what are the elements by which we ourselves personally, you know what I'm saying? Because it's not as the temple president you'll figure it out. It's you as a devotee, the individual, you'll figure it out. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? I mean, of course, there is some special intelligence and that afforded when one takes up that responsibility for Krishna. So things that you didn't think about before, and things you can do now that one's taken that position as the president. That's Krishna's mercy. But still, you as the individual can improve the quality of that. That's what you're trying to do. So if you're sincerely trying to improve it, even if you have faults, people won't see that. At least not the sincere ones. Right? Because the insincere ones generally don't give money anyway, so don't worry about them. Right, you know, worry about them once you get everything established. Then you try to get them. Like Lord Chaitanya is catching first, but then he's lamenting that even the Pashandis and these, they're not. Right, you know, so how to catch them also. But at the first, who in your community would you consider Krishna consciously sincere? Right, you know, and supportive. Cultivate them first. And when you start to see what works with them that makes it dynamic, then slowly, slowly start to extend that. Because the point is a community won't happen overnight. Don't try to make it happen, you know, like that. Like Chaupati to where it is now, they started back in the 80s. Like that. Might have even been earlier, but I think early 80s. So it came to be kind of known what it is, you know, I would say when? Yeah, after probably 20 years, 18 to 20 years, then it was, you know, dynamic. And then at that time, that early 2000, it was like, I think they had 700 like full, you know, 16 round devotees, but they had a community of 1500 who were, you know, involved in chanting a little bit and this and that. And so from then to now, in another 10 years, it's gone from, you know, 700, you know, 1500 to 7000. You know, so it's going, you know, exponentially. So that's the kind of thing is, though. Target those who you know you have some, but don't take it for granted. In other words, find what it is they're looking for, what they're inspired by, increase that. And what they're not, try to work on. And if it's a matter of what you're doing is fine, but they're not happy, then you have to educate them why it is fine. But if it's something that could be improved, then be willing to improve it. That's why we're going through this, so that we know what are the areas to look at. What is our right that we don't have to change, and what it is we should be willing to change. Right? Like we saw there. As an authority, it'll come up, as an authority, we can be strong with the dependents, but at the same time as we're always trying to speak as sweetly as possible. That's the standard. But if it doesn't work, then we might yell at them, you know, and then we go back to speaking nicely, you know. Like that. I think it was Theodore Roosevelt. He was the president in America, I think, during like World War II and stuff like that. He was like he did 16 years. It was after him they made this rule, he can only be president for 8 years, 2 terms. So he did 4 terms. one of his mottos was, speak softly, but carry a big stick. You know? In other words, you speak nicely, but they know, if you don't, I remember Bhavananda. He was a very good manager. Still is a very good manager. So, because, you know, he had just Brahmacharya, he's a crazy, India, early India, so generally you had to be a bit nuts to be in India at that time. So everyone was extremely independent. So he was very strong, you know. He was really strong. Though I must admit, if Jayapataka Maharaj ever yelled, you didn't want to know about it. But I've only seen that happen twice. But he'd yell, you'd think everything's falling apart. It was like, you know, everything shakes. It's this thing. You know, Bhavananda would be intellectually, you know, just to the point, logical, just smash you. But Jayapataka Maharaj, he'd roar. The walls would shake. It was like, you know. So, but Bhavananda would, you know, he'd always be yelling and yelling and yelling until everybody started to get it together. And then that was in the 70s. Then I remember in the 80s, I never saw him yell. But everybody knew he could. So no one did anything wrong. And he could always be very pleasant and nice and, you know, accommodating and all that, because as soon as you stepped out of line, you knew you'd get it. You understand? So the point is here is you start off soft, and if it doesn't work, then you're hard when it needs to be. But then when it doesn't, you go back to being soft, because then they can see the contrast. They'd much rather you nice than not nice. Right? But if you're going to be not nice when they're doing things right, and you're going to be not nice when they do things wrong, why do they have to make the extra endeavor? So they'd rather see you nice. Right? Especially a lady, right? Nice ladies are really nice. Not nice ladies are really not nice. You know, so if they're smart, they'll stick the nice lady, right? You know, it's like, you're like good cop, bad cop, you know, it's like that. Yes. Yes.
It was always like this, with parents, with everybody else. So I never really experienced this, like being nasty on somebody and somebody really being Trina Apisunichina and showing this in practice. I never saw this. So maybe that's my only case. So that's one of the disadvantages to...
So you don't know who to yell at, so you're yelling at all the wrong people. Yeah, I'm saying you're not being not nice to all the wrong people. See, you have to pick out who to not be nice to, and then you'll get the right response. Right? Does that make sense? No?
Well, it doesn't come like pick up, you know, it comes...
No. Yeah, it was a joke there. No, because the point is not being nice will always get the response. Because here... is I'm not sure you could equate that with what she said. Because here it was just being heavy. It wasn't that she was being unkind. She was just yelling at them why they weren't doing their service properly. So there's nothing wrong there. But not being nice, that doesn't have an excuse. So therefore, if you're not nice, it'll always be greeted with not niceness. You know, maybe I'm sure if you bumped into the Python Sadhu in 11th Canto, Prahlad Maharaj, you know, some of these, then you would find what we're talking about here, you know, Haridas Thakur, you know. But otherwise then, because it's an emotion, here it was driven by an emotion of frustration, but the point was to get this work done, and it was just yelling because it got that element of fear. No one said she wasn't nice. They said you were strong. So you have to be able to distinguish between being strong or being firm and being not nice. Does that make sense? Okay, Jaiho. So we'll, I guess, end here. So, well, yeah, so we seem to have hit a few issues today. So we only got through, yeah. One page, like that. We don't hit issues, we get through quite a bit. But it's understood is that in the beginning we'll hit more of these things, just like I saw when we're dealing with the Gita, when we're going through the Gita. The first six chapters, all the issues, all the different things, all the different, it will all come on there. We hit the middle six chapters, then not so much because it's all about devotional service, so we're familiar with that. But by the time we got to the last six chapters, which are really technical, then there was no problems. Everyone just understood it and all that. So these are the things, because right here, what are we dealing with? We're dealing with authority and respect of authority. So that's the real underlying issue of administration. If there's no authority, there is no administration. Like that. There is no management. So it's not a problem. So when that is, we're adjusted with that, understand how to balance it, then we'll see the other stuff will go really easy. Because this is the first point, respect of authority. Right? Once that's there, then everything else will work. Because if you don't respect authority, you don't respect, you know, guru, you don't respect the, you know, in ashram, you know, the order there, sannyasis, vanaprasthas, grihasthas, brahmas, you don't respect the varnas, you know, so that means you can't make anything work socially, spiritually, economically. Without authority, none of this works. Dharma, artha, kama, and moksha will not work unless, just even bottom line, to give a kind of a rough example, means if the husband and wife, you know, want to get intimate with each other, if there's not mutual respect, it won't happen. Yeah. It just won't happen. Even just the bottom line, the modern society is totally freaked out about sex. You're not going to have sex unless there's a respect for the other party. So even that won't work without respect. So why would something higher than that of artha, which is your justice, morality, and economics, why would that work without respect? And dharma, you know, that's the central point. You know, and moksha is not going to work without that either, because if you can't see the soul, if you're so caught up in their what they've done wrong on the material platform, you're not seeing the soul, so you're never going to get to the liberated platform. And then beyond all that, then there's Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? So it's just respect is the first. So when that's clear and we can see how to balance it. Because as we said, there's the authority of the temple president, then there's the individual who is the temple president. Right? So Yudhishthira, he is the emperor, so he does the duties of the emperor, but he considers himself just a devotee. So he's practicing his spiritual life as a devotee. But he has the conditioned nature to serve Krishna as the emperor of the world, so he does those duties. So that's the thing, we have to be able to balance. There's a purport where Prabhupada says you have to be able to deal with both of these at once. You know, he's a devotee and he's a kshatriya. We have to be able to deal with two. But what we try to do is blend the two, but it doesn't come out as a devotee. Like Chaitanya Charitamrita, most of the people in there, I mean, like Raghunath Das Goswami, his father and uncle, and there's no other issue, and there's nobody else in the family. They make 2 million gold coins a year, right? Does that make sense? So 2 million gold coins, that's how much they make. How much can three men spend, right? No saris, no nothing. How much can they spend, right? So a gold coin will be like 8 to 10 grams, right? 1 gram is, I don't know how much it's worth over here, but you know, 35 euros a gram. You sure? No, can't be. 100 euros is... Oh, maybe. Yeah, no. Yeah, around 35 euros a gram. Okay, so take 35 times 10, right? So that's 350 times 2 million. Okay? So that means they make 700 million euros a year in gold. Not on paper, not in stocks, right? In gold, a year, right? But do you ever see any attitude of that element of wealth in either his father, his uncle, or himself, right? Pundarik Vidyaniti, he's a king. like that. You understand? So all the members of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Rupa Goswami is the treasurer for the Nawab, and Raghunath Das Goswami's parents, they're getting 2 million as their cut for being the tax collectors. So you can imagine how much they're giving to the king, and they're just one tax collector. So how much money is the Nawab making? And he's going out and conquering other countries. So how much? And Rupa Goswami manages that. He's the treasurer for a country, right? Most places you don't have one person as the treasurer; you have this whole group, right? What do you call it? The Federal Reserve, you know. It's a private business. But here's one person, and then while he's out managing, it's Sanatana Goswami. So Sanatana Goswami manages the whole kingdom because the king's out having fun conquering other kingdoms. So Sanatana Goswami is the prime minister of the whole of East India. Because when we say Bengal, we mean Bengal, Bangladesh, part of Orissa, Assam, and all those other little countries. Other little states, means. That's Bengal. But do we hear anything? Lord Chaitanya, they're from, you know, top Brahmin family. They're all these people are so qualified, but there's no smell of that. Because they're devotees who do that as a service. But we reverse it because we do this as a service. This is us, and this is the smell. This is the fragrance. Right? So the person doesn't smell like a devotee. The fragrance is, I'm a temple president. So unless you're a really good temple president, you know, high grade, then the fragrance isn't appreciated. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? So that's the problem. We're merging them, but we're merging it from the wrong side. You know, it's like on your iPhone, you have all those applications. If you put one into another, if you start out with, let's say, iPod, anything else you put into it, it'll say entertainment. Mm-hmm. But if you start with a different one and put the iPod into there, it'll say what that says. You understand? So that's the point. It's not, if you take devotee and put that into president, it'll smell like president. But if you take president and put it into devotee, it'll smell like devotee. That's what we have to learn to do. So they see you as the leading devotee. That's the leader. Leader means you're the leading devotee. Right? On a day-to-day basis. Right? But that doesn't mean that there's not others. Like the parents are the leader in the family. They're the ones you go to. You interact. So, but you do have relatives that visit, or you know, the priest that comes, or other people that come, and that adds something to it. But their foundation is the president. So it should be the president is, you know, that leader of the community. You know. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jainatai Gaura Premanandi.